WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. President Trump announces a travel ban affecting a dozen countries. It's set to go into effect on Monday.
I am signing a new executive order placing travel restrictions on countries including Yemen, Somalia, Haiti, Libya, and numerous others.
The proclamation partially restricts entry of people from seven countries. Trump wants an investigation into former President Biden's use of an auto pen to sign pardons and other documents. And as CBS's Matt Piper also reports,
a memo from the administration says for years, President Biden suffered from serious cognitive decline. It also says they will investigate Biden's mental health and whether people in his inner circle conspired to deceive the public.
The administration's 50% tariff hikes on steel and aluminum imports are now in effect, and CBS's Kelly O'Grady says it's going to affect items big and small.
You're
going
to see cars impacted, as well as beer cans, soda cans, homes.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Milwaukee Brewers win again. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska filling in for Mike Clemens. Milwaukee defeated Cincinnati 9-1 today to take two of three games in the series. Jackson Churio had three hits, including a two-run home run to help spark the Brewers' offense.
Speaking of Churio, fly ball out to right, sending Benson back. He is staring and gone. Jackson Churio hits his 10th home run of the season. And the Brewers jump out to a 3-0 lead.
That call courtesy of FanDuel Sports Wisconsin. Three Brewers pitchers combined to allow just four hits and one run, with Quinn Priester getting the victory. It's the ninth win for the Brewers in their past 10 games. Milwaukee heads back home to play the San Diego Padres starting on Friday. With a 21-5 victory today over Messiah, UW-Whitewater clinched the Division III College Baseball Championship. It's the Warhawks' third title and first since 2014. Tonight is the start of the Stanley Cup Finals between Florida and Edmonton. The NBA Finals begin tomorrow as Oklahoma City takes on Indiana. Filling in for Mike Clemens, I'm Jimmy Cuska with Civic Media Sports.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Anyone have June 3rd as Bromance Dissolution Day? If not, well, like me, I had it much sooner. I thought the Trump-Musk bromance would have ended a little while ago. I didn't think Trump's ego would allow Dogeboy to hang around and take the headlines, take the spotlight. I didn't think he'd allow it. I thought Trump would have thrown him under the bus. Clearly there's something there that I don't know. Clearly the strings on the puppet are stronger than I had originally thought. I guess when someone gives you a couple $100 million to win an election, I guess, you know, you want to keep them around. But hey, Bromance Dissolution Day, June 3rd. I'm calling it. That is it. Because yesterday what you had is you had Elon going on Twitter in what sounded like a suicide note to begin, but was really the breakup. Was the Dear Don letter where Musk tweeted out, "I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination." And then I was waiting for him to step off the ledge. But he goes on. He says, shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it. It will massively increase the already gigantic budget deficit to $2 trillion and burden American citizens with crushing, unsustainable debt. By giving people like him tax cuts. And this is where I keep coming back to. Democrats, you got an opportunity. Now you've got the bromance broken up. Now you can pit them against each other, because it was just, what was it, the day before where Musk said he wasn't going to get in the middle? He's going to... Whatever's going on there. I don't know. But what we do know is, once again, working people are going to take it on the chin, being asked to shoulder the burden for Washington's broken priorities. In a letter from public health and policy researchers at Yale University and the University of Pennsylvania, sent to Ron Wyden and Bernie Sanders, both senators, obviously, they warn that provisions in the House passed federal budget reconciliation bill could lead to more than 51,000 unnecessary deaths each and every year if that big, beautiful nightmare becomes law. Why? Well, what they're saying is it guts health protections that millions of us rely on, cutting Medicaid, rolling back nursing home staffing rules, and letting the Affordable Care Act premium assistance program expire. That means more people losing insurance, more seniors left without proper care, and of course, families being forced to choose between medicine and groceries. This isn't about numbers on a spreadsheet. This is about people's lives. This is about our friends, our neighbors, our communities. It's about us. It's about working people. And what the researchers are saying is these cuts are going to kill tens of thousands of people. And what we say is, well, working families didn't cause this crisis. We shouldn't be the ones, again, to shoulder the burdens of the mistakes of the past. So we need to tell the Senate, kill this abomination. Even Elon's saying it's bad. And when Doge Boy is saying something is bad, I don't know. He couldn't get his $2 trillion in slash and burn, so I guess this is part of it. Now, according to the authors of the letter, what they've looked at is the fact that the 7.7 million people are going to lose health insurance. They're going to lose coverage, which they're estimating will cost over 11,000 people their lives. 11,300 is what they're saying. The disenrollment of 1.4 million low-income folks off of Medicare, that's going to cause about 18,200 deaths per year. Because when you end the Medicaid savings program, that's a problem. Also, reducing access to subsidized prescriptions, that's a problem. And when you eliminate the CMS nursing home staffing rules, they're talking another 13,000 deaths annually by not having minimum staffing standards. And you throw all this together, and the bill's failure to extend the ACA's enhanced premium tax credit is going to push another 5 million people into the world of the uninsured. And they're saying almost 9,000 more deaths each year. So over 51,000 people, you, me, one of us could be next. But these are their priorities. Why? Tax cuts for rich people. Tax cuts for Elon. Call your senator, especially your Republican ones. Maybe show up to one of their town hall meetings so that they can tell you, well, you're going to die anyway. Because that's what they believe. That's the reality. And this administration, they don't care about you. They don't care about working people. They certainly don't care about me. Maybe it's time we push back. Maybe. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Let me know what you think. Or are these just 51,000 people we could do without every year? There's some on the right that believe that. I want to hear your thoughts. rick@therickssmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project is going to be here.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as I've said in the past, in my opinion, of all of the Trump loyalists, RFK Jr. at HHS has to be the most dangerous, or at the very top of the most dangerous list. And it's because, look, the administration clearly going after everything that has been the norm of past, especially around vaccines, as they've ended funding for HIV vaccine research. If you look at the Make America Healthy Again Commission report, more interested in conspiracy theory and ideology than actual health, when it contradicted the CDC on vaccines for kids, you know, wanted to, removing fluoride from drinking water, and of course, the kookery displayed, you know, that they throw out as science, where actual science they ridicule. To me, scary stuff. So for good information, we have to make sure we find that. And more than ever, it's important. And here to help us wade through the RFK Jr. / Trump sewer pond of disinformation, I've asked my good friend Jeff Hauser to come share some thoughts. Jeff is the executive director of the Revolving Door Project, the revolvingdoorproject.org, their website. Jeff, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick.
So I look at where we are in this moment, and, you know, I guess the question for you is, how do you see RFK Jr. and this whole MAHA movement hijacking legitimate public health concerns? And why do you think that their message has any legs and is resonating with anyone?
I think it's a great question. I think it's one that Democrats really need to be asking. I think that we live in a properly cynical era. Like, we are aware that powerful people can do wrong. America has become, you know, increasingly cynical, almost in a straight line for the last two or three generations, ever since Vietnam and Watergate. And the raft of revelations that filtered throughout society in the 1970s, we become more cynical. And so a lot of politics is about what cynicism is appropriate, what cynicism is compelling to people. And for too long, Democrats have not discussed the growing health problems in this country. And that's created a vacuum. I think people understand that something is wrong, that we are a rich country that spends an insane amount of money on healthcare. Obviously, we don't provide universal healthcare, and we should, but in terms of the percentage of our overall gross domestic product, we spend an unusually high share of an unusually high gross domestic product for health, and people die earlier. So obviously, there are aspects of American life that are not healthy. And so somebody giving voice to the concerns that we all have about that lack of health, if you're offering a purported explanation and the other side is silent, an answer beats no answer, even if that answer is conspiratorial garbage. And so RFK Jr. purports to offer answers. It's very easy to offer answers when you're not bound by the limits of science, and you can kind of just say whatever you want. I guess the only constraint on what RFK Jr. used to say is who was sponsoring him. And frankly, that's also true of a whole host of podcasts, like, you know, Joe Rogan relies, you know, substantially on his economic model on vitamin supplements. And that's a huge, the manosphere and the ways in which the right has been gaining among young men is interconnected with growth supplements, which altogether too often are probably human growth hormone or steroids, one way or another. But there's just a lot of quackery out there in terms of medicine, because there's a lot of mistrust of big pharma, which makes sense. But there's not a lot of good science, and there's not a lot of faith in science.
Yeah. I remember my first encounter with any of the quackery that comes out of RFK Jr. was back in 2001 into 2002, My oldest daughter, my wife was pregnant with our oldest daughter, and he was all in the news about how, vaccines and how all of the tamoxifen in the vaccines was causing autism, and it was all this stuff. And, it kind of had me freaked out. So I went to my pediatrician, and fortunately I had a doctor that I trusted, someone that actually knows something. And she walked us through what was fact, what was fiction, what was just total garbage. And he got a lot of people around that time all lathered up, and in many cases for absolutely no reason. And in fact, turned some of our friends against vaccines entirely. So for me, my distrust of anything coming out of RFK Jr.'s mouth is that of skepticism. I trust nothing that comes out of his mouth because of that experience.
And you should not trust him. I mean, he lies on every day that ends with the letter Y. I mean, that's just what he does. But he is persistent. He is shameless. And he takes advantage of the fact that, autism diagnoses are certainly on the way up. Now, some of that's because we're much more cognizant of autism. And so I'm sure there were many more cases missed in the past than now. So the increase may or may not be totally reflecting any actual change. But it makes sense that people would be worried. But it strikes me as much more likely that it is chemicals being unleashed and a failure to enforce environmental laws that would cause any environmental, right, to the extent to which there are environmental problems. I fear attacks on clean air and clean water much more than I do a conspiracy. Because the secret is, while Moderna made a decent amount of money on the COVID vaccine because they came out quickly and they got there first and they were set up to do so, Operation Warp Speed being kind of the only thing the Trump administration did well its first time around. Now they're disavowing it. In general, Big Pharma actually doesn't make much money on vaccines. That's not where pharma makes its money, which is one of the big problems in this entire set of conspiracies. They make their money overcharging people for pharmaceuticals that ought to be sold at generics at modest markups over cost. That's where they make their money. They don't make it on vaccines, but that's not something you're going to hear from RFK Jr. or his acolytes.
So when you say he lies, is it that he lies or he knows, to use a Ronald Reagan frame, he knows so much that isn't true?
I think it's very hard to say. I mean, this is the guy whose brainworm story is apparently not even just a wild old wives' tale, but has some biological basis, which I don't know. I'm definitely not a brain scientist, so I think the lesson of criticizing RFK Jr. is I won't necessarily purport to exactly identifying what are the causes into his rampant dishonesty. But I think it is clear that he does not put great stock in the importance of being correct.
I'm with you on that.
At that point, once you're willfully wrong, I don't really care more about your motives than that.
So given this, and look, the reality is the blind squirrel, and Trump for me is the same way. The blind squirrel eventually finds a nut. For me, with Trump, it's about how bad our economy's been shifted away from manufacturing and toward service and automation, and how the massive redistribution of wealth has destroyed the working class in this country. Now, granted, I don't think any of his policies or even if he has a solution is anywhere in the right ballpark. But I do think RFK, in the same vein, has tripped over, like you said, chemicals in our air and our water and our food supply that's been corporatized. For me, these are kind of big things that maybe we should be talking about in a much healthier way, as opposed to having some conspiratorial, error-ridden commission come up with some port that I don't think anyone's gonna put any stock in.
Yeah, I mean, there have been, Michael Pollan comes to mind, but there have been for decades, progressively, but loosely, not especially political science-oriented writers have been raising questions with the food industry in this country and whether or not the food processing causes problems. There are ever more books out there about overly processed foods. And I don't purport to be an expert on just the nature of the problem and what are the greater causes. Yeah. My sense is the seed oil issue is vastly overstated, but corn sweeteners,
the high fructose really corn syrup,
do seem problematic. So I'm not going to get into the weeds of it, but I definitely think there is some there. But what's mostly been happening is big companies are paying lobbyists and are forestalling regulation that would keep us safer. Yeah. And in general, the progressive notion of how we protect people from rapacious corporations, is that we empower scientists to do the work and act protectively, is a lot smarter than, you know, wildly just listening to what supplements sellers want to do.
Which are unregulated supplements, which I always find hysterical. But let me ask you this, because you brought up regulations. And, you know, much of what Trump's policy, much of what the right's policies are aimed at dismantling the regulatory state, especially, you know, things like NIH and the FDA. What do you see as the risks associated with that assault? And you know, how does it serve corporate interests at the expense of public health?
So I think Doge is just nuts. And I think that Doge reflects a lot of people who have their own version of brain worms, literal or metaphorical, like Elon Musk, taking conservative ideology far too seriously. If you came into government with the assumption that people who work in government, especially those who've done it for an entire career, they must stink because, like, why aren't they rich and in the private sector? And we're going to fire a bunch of people. I think Doge cut a lot of people because of the pro-corporate ideology of attacking government and attacking so-called government bureaucrats and government scientists and stuff. And so I don't think they cut them with necessarily always a terrific plan in mind, or even like a conspiracy. So I think they're cutting NIH and FDA and putting somebody in charge of FEMA who didn't know that there's a hurricane season in this country. When they're doing this, there's not a master plan, and there's not necessarily a specific corporation that's going to get rich off of less science being supported by the National Institutes of Health. They are going to get rich because the overall ideology of the right is we need to cut supposedly wasteful government spending in order to fund tax cuts for the rich. And they want tax cuts for the rich. So they're cutting willy-nilly.
Sure.
So I'm not sure that there's going to be direct beneficiaries. I can think of a lot of companies, including our pharmaceutical, like the science industry, the pharma industry, the biotech industry in this country, it's going to get a lot poorer as a result of the lack of government subsidies from the National Institutes of the Health. And also, we'll have like fewer life-saving innovations. I don't know if anyone's going to get rich off it, but it is in pursuit of the broader tax cuts for the rich agenda.
Yeah, well, ultimately, I think Grover Norquist said it best. He wants government so small that they can drag it in the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub. Absolutely. And this, to me, is the right-wing ideology in everything that they do. So as they're going after NIH and the FDA and every regulatory body, it's about shifting control away from we the people into the hands of corporate interest or the Wild West laissez-faire free market. That seems to be the undercurrent of all of this, in my view.
Yeah. I mean, like, so to continue the bathtub analogy about, you know, he wants it to be able to, you know, go into the bathtub. He's also throwing when he's throwing out the bathwater, the baby's involved. Like, they're throwing the babies out. So it's really bad. And I think it just shows that there's just nothing legitimate or substantive to this ostensible philosophy. Like, when you hear people say, oh, I'm a social liberal, but a fiscal conservative, I believe in small government. I mean, then you think like the government should not be solving the COVID crisis, so we would have been better off without vaccines. I mean, which I guess maybe that gets you back to the RFK Jr. Of it all. But yeah, I mean, those of us who preferred to not die of disease needlessly have very little to see in small government conservatism.
Yeah. Now, you guys have cataloged, major anti-vax and deregulatory actions by this administration. What trends have emerged and how these policies are implemented at the federal and state level? And how should progressive watchdog organizations, much like yours, prioritize their responses?
So, I mean, there are ripple effects. And so we are very much in the early stages of seeing what I imagine are unfortunately going to be catastrophes. Because as you start cutting grants to state and local governments, they eventually are going to start terminating public health workers. Those are the people on the front lines of finding out if we have a new disease, getting cures out there, getting medicine, getting people treated. You have issues like bird flu. We have the rebirth of measles in this country due to people like RFK Jr. We're losing our frontline work. We are losing our capacity to respond as things get bad. But that doesn't mean on day one, we're going to see a brand new full stage epidemic. So it's all going to get a lot worse. I think the job of progressive organizations is to essentially make these sad and scary, but I think justified predictions in advance and track them. So unfortunately, if and when these things happen, we can try to hold the administration to account. Like, politics in a democracy only works if there's accountability for failure.
Sure.
And so I think we believe there's going to be a lot of terrible failure. We'd rather be wrong than proven right. But at the best case scenario, if we are proven right, is that there is at least accountability for these messes, that we predicted them, pointed out how they could have been prevented, and so that we have some credibility and ability to exact a political cost when those consequences manifest as predicted.
Yeah, no, as I've been saying since
I get ahead of stuff.
As I've been saying since Election Day, you know, the solutions will come out of the suffering caused by their savagery. All of this stuff that they're doing will cause suffering. And as long as we're paying attention and we're organizing around that suffering, the solutions will come out of that on the other side. And I look at groups like yours, like the Revolving Door Project. You're not a public health organization, but you've taken kind of on some work to look at the overlap with corporate influence. What role do you see for cross-sector collaboration in combating the massive amount of disinformation that's out there and really the underinvestment in public health? How do you see that going forward?
Yeah, so on our website at therevolvingdoorproject.org, we have a page called DogeWatch. And if you use Google, do DogeWatch Revolving Door, it'll come up as well. And we are tracking things like bird flu and measles. We're writing stories about what goes wrong. And what we hope to do is, like this conversation, is to get people who have audiences talking about these issues, beginning to track these issues. People can bring them to our fore. If people are tracking different elements of the public health crises that are emerging, we are happily linked to them. One of the links on our DogeWatch page is to a link to other people tracking stuff about Trump. Like, so we have a nearly comprehensive tracker of trackers of the Trump administration. So that way, you know, whatever issue motivates you, we either ourselves are tracking it, or hopefully we are helping you get to the people who are tracking it. Because what we need in our social media era is as many people as possible to use their own microphones. So you have, you know, a traditional radio show as well as a podcast. Other people may or may not have that, but they have audiences on whatever social media platform that they are using. They have word of mouth. They are members of communities. We want them to be empowered to talk about the specific examples that resonate with them. You know, some people are going to talk about veterans issues. Other people are going to talk about labor issues. Some people are going to talk about, you know, how Ukraine is being sold out. Whatever motivates you in talking about this administration, people should be helping you not have to keep track of all the different facts, provide you with reliable information. But people who are, you know, sitting in D.C. like myself, I shouldn't be telling people exactly how to talk about it.
Right.
You guys, you being whomever, know your audience better than I do. So the job for organizations like ours is to collect information that's reliable. And then it's the job of all of us in our democracy to hold politicians to account.
And by audience, you mean friends and neighbors and coworkers and all that
yes,
stuff.
Exactly.
We used to call them friends and neighbors and coworkers. Now it's our audience, which is twisted and bizarre.
Power, we have influence. Yeah, it's very weird. But,
It's the brave new world. Last question I've got for you, because look, you know, the reality is that what you're talking about is the fact that, you know, this administration has a war on data collection. So none of the things that you're talking about, we are going to probably keep track of anymore. So we got to do it for ourselves. And I guess the question is how can progressives reclaim the narrative around what we've talked about and do it in a way from both a populist and a science-based kind of fact-based world?
I think it's multiple parts. Part of it is having groups being reliable and collecting information. And then I think part of it is that we need the Democrats to understand that there doesn't need to be a single message at any given time. Part of why MAHA was so critical to the Trump coalition is that there exists this niche, pretty large niche, but still a subunit of people who talk all the time about issues like food safety and water safety and vaccines. And maybe they're saying crazy stuff and sometimes they're saying more valid stuff, but that they talk about this a lot of the time. And you need to empower people to go into those spaces or set up their own spaces and talk about this, even if the issue of the day is a plane crash or the issue of the day is a foreign policy mess or a terrorist attack or there's not just one conversation in America happening. All of us, whether you call us influencers or podcasters or people just talking to friends and neighbors, we all know what our audience is interested in, what our network is interested in, and we should talk about it in our language. And we shouldn't feel like, well, if Hakeem Jeffries or Chuck Schumer is talking about topic A today, if I'm going to talk politics, I have to be on that topic.
Yeah, generally, no. if Chuck Schumer is talking about something, I'm not paying attention. That's just my world. But Jeff, as always, great stuff. I appreciate you taking some time. Hope folks will check out therevolvingdoorproject.org. We'll get links out on social media. Jeff Hauser, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Are you buying what the MAHA people are selling? Is that kernel of reality resonating? Or do you see it as I do? A lot of quackery and a lot of kookery with the seed of maybe a touch of reality. Want to hear your thoughts? Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
This is 93.5 The Tap. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. A stray evening shower, otherwise partly cloudy tonight, low 50s. For tomorrow, starting with sunshine, then increasing clouds for the afternoon, some showers possible into the evening, a high in the upper 70s. A better chance of rain Friday, high 70s. Currently, it's 66.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Lily Roberts, she is from the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
They're trying to pretend that this bill would be good for the working class because of this really small carve out to our tax laws. The no tax on tips piece does not at all even come close to addressing the problem of wages in this country. You know, a third of workers who work for tips in the first place don't make enough money to pay taxes at all.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So according to the International Trade Union Confederation's 2025 Global Rights Index, workers' rights around the globe are, well, under attack, or to use their words, in free fall, while on the other side, authoritarianism doing just fine. Actually on the rise. The rich getting richer, more powerful, and, well, the rest of us, not. And here to share some thoughts on just that, I've asked my good friend Michael Sonato to come share some thoughts. Michael's a labor reporter over at The Guardian U.S. You can check out their website, theguardian.com. He's got a piece out on how Trump's taking a wrecking ball to workers' rights amid the global free fall. Michael Sonato, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So let's start right at the beginning. What specific things has Trump done? What's the Trump administration done? What's been cited in this report as, well, contributing to this free fall and the deterioration of workers' rights here in this country?
So as soon as Trump got into office, he started targeting workers, federal workers, the Department of Labor. So he's tried to eliminate collective bargaining rights for most federal workers, except police and some large swaths of workers. He tried to get rid of collective bargaining for TSA workers. This past week, a court issued an injunction to stop that. He's trying to reclassify federal workers to make them all at-will employees and basically making them pay out of their pensions for it. So they can either relinquish their rights or and pay more in their pension contributions or pay less and work as at-will employees. And then, you know, this has continued into the private sector as well, and especially internationally. They've cut all the international labor grants. So all these programs that were, five-year programs focused on, eliminating or, fighting child labor, slavery abroad in different countries, all those grants were cut, and even in, you know, by DOGE, even in with programs and research that were, you know, years in already being progressed. So just canceling the work that was already been doing, wasting the money that was already spent, and just, you know, taking a wrecking ball to get to yeah. that. He fired Wilcox, the NLRB board member, and the Supreme Court said that that was okay. So, you know, he did that with the federal mediation. He got rid of that board, eliminated all of those people. The Federal Labor Relations Authority, he fired a chair there. So really at every avenue of workers' rights, he's cut, you know, gutted OSHA, gutted NIOSH, worker safety. So in all different avenues when it comes to workers and what the infrastructure was existing, it's taking a huge hit.
And I can hear my Red Hat union member friends going, so what's he done? I mean, you just spent, you know, the last couple of minutes going through a laundry list of horrible, and yet for my Red Hat friends, they're not, it hasn't hit them yet. It's going to, but not yet. But interestingly enough, you know, just yesterday I had a conversation with somebody, because I'm glad you brought up, you know, the funding for international programs on the labor front. And I said, you know, what would have happened, you know, during the Reagan years, had Reagan said, you know what, we're going to walk away from international funding. We're not going to give the Polish Solidarity Movement any resources. We're going to let them fall flat on their face. There'd be no Lech Walesa, who quite honestly wrote not too long ago a letter condemning Trump's behavior. You know, what would have happened had we been this country then? You know, would you have seen the fall of the Soviet Union? Would you have seen the rise of democracy across the globe? Or would we all be communists now?
You know, exactly. Well, you know, the, you know, political landscape has changed where that, you know, all those fundings, that those funds and those budgets and those programs aren't, you know, are viewed, they're viewed as just, you know, they're denigrated as waste, as, you know, all these conspiracy theories about USAID and, you know, what these programs were doing when, you know, these were people that were, you know, eradicating diseases and providing significant funding and support for, you know, in countries and resources that, you know, are starved of them. So the impacts are already, just people are dying just because of the USAID cuts, and it's just drastic. And the other end of that, authoritarianism is on the rise. You know, so you saw Poland just elected an authoritarian leader. You know, J.D. Vance was out, you know, support, and Elon Musk is out supporting the far right party in Germany. They're in glad handing with Maloney in Italy. So it's gone global. Europe great again movement, and you know, all this whole movement just, it doesn't bode well for workers, for workers' rights, you know, not only in the U.S. but yeah, I think we're seeing it cascade,
right, as this report points out. But the one thing I guess we are making great again, and we're making patronage great again, and patronage essays. We're going to bring loyalty tests back. I'm waiting for Yellow Dog Contracts to rear their ugly head again. But hey, you know, I guess we got to go through this, right? But here's the thing. You know, this Luke Triangle argues that elected leaders are increasingly targeting trade unions and workers' rights. You know, Trump, and not just here, but across the globe. Why does he believe that these groups are the first to be targets? And what does he suggest that we do about it? What the labor movement should be doing in democratic countries, or still democratic countries for now, like here in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's historically what's happened. Trade unions are targeted because they're just, you know, vehicles for democracy. You know, that's what unions are. They are comprised of their members. You know, the workers are the union. And you know, a lot gets done in historically, you know, through unionism, improving wages, you know, addressing social injustices, things of that nature. So, when those things are attacked, that's just it's been in the playbook of authoritarianism. Mussolini did it. Hitler did it. You've seen authoritarian countries, they go after unions, or they turn unions into something in a vehicle where they can just assert control and dominance over the populace. So
no, I've asked a number of times, who's going to be this generation's Richard Lech, who was Hitler's labor guy. When they did away with all independent labor unions, this Richard Lech guy was the union leader in Germany from 33 until 45. He was the guy. They still had unions. They just weren't democratic or independent. They were more for control than for demanding better lives and better wages, hours, and conditions. Now, in the report, it shows this global trend toward worsening labor conditions, which I don't quite get. But here at home, same kind of thing. Now, what do you think is driving this? What's driving this push to allow authoritarians to do this stuff? Or is it just, misinformation or not knowing or not caring? Because, I'm curious. You have a thought?
I think it's a lot of different factors. But I think just the big one is kind of just the failures of neoliberalism, democratic institutions, democracy, corruption from, the ultra wealthy who have been able to influence and just undermine institutions. So, when people do get elected with the promises of enacting, liberal and progressive ideas, they don't, the trade union is focusing on democracy, not just democracy, but democracy that delivers. So I think that's kind of the failure. That's the failure here in the U.S. is just, income and wealth inequality has continued to soar. Even after the 2008 economic recession, the wealthiest gotten richer, and the working man and communities across the U.S. have just degraded more and more.
Yeah.
And when people like Trump come along, where they're blaming the globalist immigrants, anyone, all
anybody but them,
culture wars, anyone and everything that gives people just an out. And and on the other side, it breeds kind of apathy when you're dismissing or not giving any deliveries in terms of actual improvements.
Yeah, no, and the perfect example is Trump came out with this no tax on tips and no tax on overtime, and I'm going, how did Democrats get scooped on this? It's something that's been around. It's something that they've actually proposed in the past. How did Republicans steal that? How did Democrats, grab defeat out of the jaws of victory when that kind of thing should have been in their wheelhouse? Now, look, I understand there are better policies that could help. There are better ways of doing this. But just from a messaging standpoint, Democrats, again, got hoodwinked, got taken in.
Absolutely. Well, that's a good example because, we just saw Harris supported it too, but didn't offer, didn't go to the point of, oh, we should get rid of the sub minimum wage because it's ridiculous that people are getting paid $2 an hour, regardless of, whether they're making tips, and it just opens, exploitative practices. So they're not willing to upset business owners or industry associations in that regard. So yes, they do get hoodwinked and scooped by someone like Trump, and really don't have a strong message or counter to those things that do wind up resonating or getting a lot of press or do get renter support, which the no tax on tips of like you said, there are a lot of problems with it, and it's the impact of it is minuscule compared to what could and should be done to help low wage workers. But the problem isn't even addressed.
No, I mean they're losing on the message at every at every opportunity. And look, you know, the reality is what we've seen right before our very eyes is a billionaire coup, not just here, but around the globe. We've seen billionaires use the enormous wealth that working people have sacrificed for them to attain this wealth through lower wages, less health care, less retirement security, more hours. You name the lowering of standard of living so we can have this billionaire class. And, you know, for me, the response should be, this is why we shouldn't have billionaires. Elon Musk, to me, is the poster child for a 92% top marginal tax rate. But somehow, here we are with a coup of billionaires taking over government and moving it in the direction that's only going to make working people's lives better or worse.
No, and that's what we've seen in recent history. And, it's something has to change. And point out and address that problem. But unfortunately, we live in a political landscape where criticizing billionaires in a substantive way is frowned upon or dismissed as socialism or anything along that nature. We're hesitant to even really address the problems, at least in the political landscape. And that's because, you know, who is donating, Citizen, it's a United, just kind of open the floodgates and, we have Trump meme coins now. So corruption is open.
But like Mike Johnson said, at least he's doing it right in front of us, not doing it like, Hunter Biden, in a back room somewhere. He's basically robbing us right in front of our face. The article, the report highlights that, while the trend globally is worsening labor rights, rising in authoritarianism, there were three countries that had some improvements in workers' rights in 2024, weren't there?
Yeah, Mexico, Australia, and Oman, which I'm not too into all of those countries, but I know from Mexico, Sheinbaum, the president there, Mexico elected a scientist, a progressive president, and she's been making inroads to kind of improving workers' rights. And even though those international labor cuts that were cut in the U.S., a lot of those were geared towards improving workers' rights for Mexican workers, because the story in past decades was, you have big countries or big companies that want to offshore jobs to workers where they're getting paid a couple bucks an hour and with like no labor laws. All the auto companies, for instance, have offshore jobs to Mexico, and that hurts Mexican workers and that hurts U.S. workers. So, those programs were ensuring that those workers had union and collective bargaining rights and could improve their wages.
And to give Trump credit, it was when he helped renegotiate the USMCA. They actually made sure that independent labor unions had the ability to exist and negotiate to his credit. And look, labor leaders pushed for that. NAFTA is his baby now. And yet, himself, going completely against what he wanted for Mexico, which, here we go. They're one of the countries that has seen some bit of a turnaround. So I guess the question I have is, and this is the last question I've got for you, because the Trump effect is pretty powerful. He could have followed Mexico and made labor rights stronger in this country, or he could do what he's doing and making it worse. I guess the question I have is a chicken or egg scenario. Does Trump make things, does he drive the agenda to where the rest of the world follows, or is he just part of the wave of authoritarianism being on the rise across the globe, or is he kind of the leader of it?
I think he's the vehicle, kind of like a patsy. I think just his role with Elon Musk, letting Elon do whatever he wants, say whatever he wanted, I think was just a prime example of, Elon Musk gave him millions and millions of dollars and just had a free pass to do whatever he wanted for, you know, the past 5-6 months, even though he was technically out of there and criticizing the big, beautiful bill now. But
the bromance is over. June 3rd, the bromance is over. Was not on my bingo card. I had thought it would be a little bit sooner, but that is it. Michael, as always, appreciate the thoughts. Great work. I hope folks will check out The Guardian, to check out your work. Great stuff. Michael Sonato, thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. So my labor hat, my labor friends, my red hat labor friends. This what you voted for? Is this what you wanted? Are you happy? Is this working for you? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day when 900 Wisconsin papermakers walked off the job from Appleton to Menasha, from Combined Lakes to Nenah. They were members of the International Brotherhood of Papermakers. At the turn of the 20th century, paper mills were an important industry in Wisconsin. The workers in these mills toiled long hours under grueling and dangerous conditions. According to historian Robert Azzone, quote, many had fingers cut off, arms burned, and bodies mangled by the open machinery and the hot rolls and felts in the mills. The workers started organizing into unions and conducting work actions, but they had little success bargaining with the mill owners. In the Wisconsin River Valley, the workers on the night shift were especially frustrated about having to work on Saturday nights. They wanted a reduction in hours and an end to the Saturday night requirement. And on this day in labor history, the union called for a strike to begin that Saturday evening at 6 p.m. Mill owners scrambled to find local mill workers willing to scab against the strike. But they had little luck. The strike began, and the workers walked off the job at 11 mills. For 10 days, things for the workers went well, and the strike was peaceful. Then the mill owners brought in replacement workers from out east. Skirmishes broke out between the scabs and the strikers. The scab replacement workers had taken away the leverage that the striking workers had had against the mill owners. Some of the strikers began to return to the mills, and the strike was defeated. Within 3 years, the Brotherhood of Papermakers would close its last lodge in Wisconsin, but worker organizing within the paper industry would continue forward.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, it's interesting to think about, you know, what would happen if Trump had been president back in the 80s? Would we be where we are? Would the globe have gone toward communism? Would the Berlin Wall have fallen? Would history have happened? Because, you know, the reason I bring up, and I'm glad Michael talked about it a little bit, the reason I bring up the Polish Solidarity Movement and Lech Walesa and that era is because without the U.S. funding things, without the someone, that beacon of hope, what happens to the globe? And where we are, and we're in an interesting moment, because we've got a president who clearly fashions himself as an authoritarian. Rules be damned, I'm going to do whatever I want. But history is one of those things that we should remember, and pulling away from, you know, international, you know, interests is kind of dangerous. And I think, you know, talking about the solidarity movement in Poland is a big thing, because, you know, in the 80s, you know, it was led by a guy named Lech Walesa, who eventually became their president. One of the most pivotal moments in the collapse of the Soviet Union and their influence across Europe. And while Reagan is often given credit for the fall of communism in the USSR, and it was workers. It was workers standing together that really made it happen. I know Republicans, like Reagan, they took credit for it, and they're good at that. But even then, I look at this administration and go, I think with a Trump in the White House in that moment, we're on the other side of that issue. I understand Solidarity was not a political thing. It was a grassroots labor movement born in the Gdansk shipyards. Its success was not really just only a Polish worker story. It was all of the support it received from the U.S., particularly from American labor unions. And, of course, our government, it was able to survive and thrive and ultimately triumph over communism because of that support. At the time, and I remember this, you know, Cold War tensions were high. The Polish government in 81 had declared martial law. The prospect of the Solidarity movement being crushed was high. It was because of the support, moral, financial, logistical, all of that stuff, that they were able to stay above and fight. And it was American labor leaders like Lane Kirkland who saw this as a struggle of kindred spirits, if you will. Under Kirkland's leadership, again, a guy who was vocal from the beginning, an active supporter of Solidarity, raised millions of dollars so that they, you know, you could provide printing presses and paper and radio equipment and all the stuff that you needed to communicate. Didn't have the internet. You needed the tools, the lifeline to keep a movement connected. And our government, you know, with Reagan, you know, they funded. They saw a strategic and a strategic opportunity. Some would say moral. I'm not going to go there. They saw a strategic opportunity. The Reagan administration, and look, they were trying to crush labor unions at home, but on this, they were on the same page. Because for Reagan, at least his rhetoric was, you know, the shining beacon on the hill, spreading democracy. This idea that we can fight for freedom. And the belief that freedom of association and workers' rights are not only democratic values, but weapons against authoritarianism. Which is why we're seeing the Trump administration doing what they're doing, attacking labor rights, attacking the ability to join and form unions, trying to outlaw federal unions. But understand, it was the U.S. involvement in the Solidarity movement that you get credit for bringing down the Berlin Wall and ending communism. And it was because of that funding that they were able to survive. And look, this chapter in history is a powerful example of how the American labor movement, how Solidarity, how foreign policy can shape the world. Supporting workers' rights at home is a democratic principle. Supporting them abroad and across the globe, not just a Cold War tactic. It's a reaffirmation of the idea that democracy begins in the workplace. And you have to defend it everywhere. This report that just came out should serve as the canary in the coal mine, if you will. Of we're now rubbing elbows with some of the worst countries for workers' rights. We're now rubbing elbows with some of the worst dictators around the globe. We're now rubbing elbows with some of the most exploitable, desperate, poverty-ridden countries on this planet. Because we've got an administration hell-bent on achieving power and control and crushing any opposition, anyone who dare question or stand in their way. We're at a crossroads right now. And the lessons of the past, again, I say we got to go back to history because we keep reliving it. The lessons of the past are going to help guide us through what's coming. And again, as I've said, this report should serve as that shining neon red light to wake us up to the reality that what we took as a birthright, democracy, freedom, liberty, the ability to work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. Those are all under attack. And it's our billionaire class. It's our Elons and our gazillionaires who have rigged the game. But as I keep saying, the solutions will come out of the suffering. The solutions will come from their savagery. And the more we wake up and realize what they're doing to us, the faster we get to those moments of, this is what we should be doing. And yeah, I want healthcare. And yeah, I want my kids to have an education. And yeah, I want good, clean water and air and sane health policy. Yeah, that's what I want. But this first. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. President Trump signs a proclamation banning travel from some countries. CBS's Jennifer Jacobs.
President Trump is instituting a new travel ban, fully restricting entry from a dozen countries, citing national security risks. The ban includes Iran, Haiti, and Somalia, but will allow for some exceptions. A proclamation signed by the president on Wednesday evening partially restricts entry for nationals from seven countries, including Venezuela, Cuba, and Sierra Leone. The new policy takes effect at 12:01 a.m. on Monday.
Early in his first term, Trump instituted a travel ban on seven predominantly Muslim countries. As President Trump pushes the Senate to pass a so-called Big Beautiful Bill, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates it will add trillions to the deficit and millions will lose Medicaid coverage. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt.
This is an institution in our country that has become partisan.